Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Garland Pepper Presents podcast. I'm your host, Gary Fox. Garland's letting me do this because he's a generous man. All right. Today, my guest is Bob Androvich. And I believe he says Androvich?
Androvich, yes.
Androvich. Bob is an artist, a local artist, a good friend. You know, they say you start living this way or that way or whatever, your energy changes and you find your tribe. And Bob's part of my tribe now. And we found each other really over the podcast. First, I'd not really met him before. We'd seen each other around, and so our first podcast would be that. As I said, Bob is an artist. What I really want to talk about is what that means. What is being an artist about, and what about you as a person just made it undeniable?
Well, I've been lucky in that I never had to be an artist to survive ever, so, you know, I can't address that viewpoint of what it means to be an artist. Because I know a lot of artists who've been artists their whole lives, and they've supported themselves strictly through their art, and I luckily was able to start making art after I didn't have to work.
Yeah.
I always wanted to make art, but, you know, right. Like everybody who works, you have to work and raise a family and do all that. So, you know, I made things, but didn't start making stuff till I was out of work, done with work.
So when you were a child, what kind of things did you create?
The first thing I remember creating was in kindergarten. This is sums it up. I was you know, kindergarten, sitting around the little round table with all the other little kindergartners, you know, seven or eight of us, and the kindergarten teacher says, okay, we're going to draw a picture of our house. She gave everybody paper. There were loose crayons out in the center of the table, and because we were kindergartners, we got the hand-me-downs from all the other grades. So there were these big, thick crayons, and, you know, I grabbed a few and started doing a drawing of my house, and I did drawing, and, you know, lawn, trees, flowers. And the teacher, you know, after we're all done, looks at, you know, Mary Jo's and says, oh, that's swell, and, you know, little Jimmy's, and goes, oh, that's wonderful, and looks at mine and goes, gee, Bobby, is your lawn red? I looked at her and I said, you know, blast off, you know, no, it's green, just like yours. And she goes, well, you colored it red. And I said, that's how my lawn looks. So I realized I was colorblind.
Yeah, interesting.
And so making art,
that really colors your world, you know.
Or decolors it. So making art for me was strictly in black and white. I was a big Zap Comics fan, you know, and started just kind of drawing to emulate more Zap Comics, some Peter Max, but because I was colorblind and had trouble with...
You like them hard lines.
Well, in black and white.
In black and white.
Can't go wrong with black and white.
High contrast.
Well, plus the business that my dad owned, I could get a lot of my stuff copied, and it wasn't easy to get stuff copied back in those days, and so he had a photo lab and stuff at his shop, so they had all high contrast photo papers, you know, all high contrast negatives and papers. So yeah, I learned to draw in high contrast.
Yeah.
And only until I got into Photoshop after I retired did I learn how to deal with my color blindness.
Yeah, because I've seen your art and...
Well, Photoshop lets me cheat.
Okay.
You build a color palette in Photoshop once.
Uh-huh.
Now I have my red, my green. You know.
It tells you. You know the numbers.
Well, yeah. Yeah, there's, you know, the Pantone color charts.
Right. And,
yeah, so you can just say, I want Pantone 187 red.
Right.
And it's always going to be Pantone 187 red, whether I think it looks like an apple.
Mystery solved. I was like,
cured.
How
one time my best friend waited till he was really young, or old to have a kid. I mean, not really old, but, you know, in his 30s.
Ah.
And he and his wife had this beautiful baby daughter. And so I said, man, I need you to give me a picture of her and I'll do a piece of art for you. So I took her picture and mounted it on a piece of board and did this really beautiful geometric pattern of kind of Art Nouveau-ish, Musha type stuff, flowers and vines. And and my wife at the time was my color checker. I used color pencils, and they didn't say what color they were, so I'd have to say, you know, is this green? Is this, you know, red? Is this brown? Is this purple? Those are my big screw-ups. So,
purple, red, green, and brown.
She had gone to bed, and I was, you know, wide awake and said, well, I got to finish this just because that's how I was. And I finished it, and I was so proud of it. It was like, man, that drawing is bitching.
Right.
And, you know, wake up in the morning, and I always got up early, made the coffee and stuff, and the wife gets up, and I go, check this out, what I made for Brett and his daughter. And she looks at it and just started laughing her ass off and goes, all of the leaves are purple.
They were right in tone. They were right in contrast.
Well, they looked.
But they were purple.
Green to me.
They were dark green.
So
purple's dark green.
Well, they were a shade. They were colored pencils, so they weren't like a dark, you know, boom, purple. But
right.
Yeah. Right. Anyway, when I got Photoshop, I learned right off the bat that you could actually, before that, there were a couple of programs I used that to design stuff before I learned Photoshop that you could build color palettes. But in Photoshop, I could scan a photo of a bush. Just easy, lots of green in it.
Right.
And I could select 5, 6, 7, 8 different types of green out of that bush and put them in my color palette.
So every time you go there, that's green?
It says green.
Yeah.
It says green number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Shades. So you see the shades.
Different green, yeah, different
density.
Some are different color green, you know, but
yeah, green. Yeah.
There's lots of greens.
There's, yeah, that's the color that most people see the most of.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the range where we're, I guess, thickest. And you say you don't see those. You see in more of a violet range.
Well, it's not that simple. No, the violet really is the weirder end of it. But a great example is I have a big window at our sink and looking out about 40 feet from our kitchen sink is a burning bush.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know what those look like?
Yeah, yeah, very bright.
And this thing's 5, 6 feet in diameter.
Mm-hmm.
Giant.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful. And I'm doing the dishes one morning, and Deb says, look at that burning bush. It's in bloom. It looks so great. And I'm like, yeah, that's cool. You know, and she's like, And yeah, she knows I'm colorblind. So
you're not getting the magnificence of it.
Well, no. So she says, can you see that? And I go, what? And she goes, well, the blooms. And I'm like, well, it's the burning bush.
Mm-hmm.
And she was like, oh, this is nuts. So she took me outside, and from about 5 feet away, 6 feet away, I can see the contrast and tell that it's different than the green.
Mm-hmm.
But from 40 feet, it looked like one shade of.
And what color are the burning bush blooms?
Fiery red. Fiery red. Yeah. Fiery, like the most brilliant bursting red color there is in a plant.
Yeah.
Against a brilliant green. I mean, non-colorblind people see it really as a total display of red and green, and I see it as a monochromatic, I mean, you know, one color deal.
Not gray, though.
Oh, no.
Mm-hmm. More in the...
One color.
It's one
more
color.
One color.
Yeah.
Don't differentiate between the red and the green. Mm-hmm. That's from a distance. From closer up, I can see there's a difference.
Okay. So the subtleties are there at some level.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a weird thing.
It is a weird thing. And to be an artist and to compose like you do, because the pictures you do are compositions.
Well, yeah, but they're, you know,
of intricate detail and color balance. There's a serious color balance that happens in a lot of your work that I just like. And now I know that there's mathematics to it. You know, you can, because you know you got your numbers.
Well, in pieces where I'm bringing
your palette.
In pieces where I'm dragging in images, which is a lot of them, color really doesn't much have anything to do with it. I mean, somewhat, but not really. It's more the image.
It balances.
Well, if it's glaringly stupid, I can tell, but yeah. Mm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that.
And there are times when I run stuff by Deb because I certainly don't want to send something to the printer and then go, oh, shit.
Right. Oh, right.
Pardon me.
Yeah, we can say that. It's the interwebs. I'll just have to say explicit material.
So, being an artist is cool. So what it means to me is now is that I just express myself constantly. Constantly. Yeah. I do a daily journal. I always wanted to be a sign painter.
But I thought about asking you to bring that today.
Oh, yeah. I constantly journal. I do like a diary, but in graphic format every day. Mm-hmm. For the last, 25 years straight.
So Bob says in graphic format, and what that means is if he's feeling something intensely or he's waiting for the stuff to come, there are different drawing types that he does. So, for instance, if he's waiting for stuff to come, he does magnificent borders of geometric forms around the page or around a section of a page, and then he'll throw a beautiful title in there with some art to it. It's amazing the way your journals are. They're really beautiful.
Oh, well, thanks. They're pretty, they keep me busy. I like it. I like to do it. I loved a letter. I'd rather a letter than do anything. Uh-huh. I guess my ideal job would have been to be a letterer in a comic, book factory, you know, mm-hmm. like Marvel or something like that.
Uh-huh.
Just do lettering. That's all. You know, you don't have to be able to draw figures or, you know.
Yeah.
Just letter.
Lettering's a very mindful practice.
Oh, man, I've been into it my whole life. I love it. I'm good at it now.
My handwriting is pretty good, but inconsistent.
And my handwriting sucks.
Well, I mean, even when I'm trying to letter.
Print like a typewriter.
Yeah. But it does. It takes a mindful kind of approach to each and every shape when you
I like
are
to
lettering.
Mess with people, you know, like at the doctor's office or at the at DMV or something, filling out forms.
Because mm-hmm.
I'll fill out a form and they get it back and they look at it and they go, how did you do this? And it's mm-hmm. like, that's how I write. And they go, yeah. You know, there have been times where they've taken it around the office and go, you know, look at yeah. this. This is weird.
Well, architects, it's a thing among architects. You spend a lot of time when you,
yeah, but
back
they,
in the old school.
But they have their own style of lettering. Every
right.
architect
right.
pretty much letters the same exact way because they're taught to.
Right. And then they develop their own way of doing
and
the
same.
And
having looked at 10 million blueprints growing up, being raised by a blueprinter,
mm-hmm.
And back in the day I grew up, they came out really slow, so you could really study them. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I learned how to do that lettering, you know, in high school,
mm-hmm.
but that wasn't it for me. It was more comic books and Zap comics mm. and more artistic.
So you did 10,000 hours Comic Sans.
Oh, God. I wish my parents were so lenient and they just let us. My parents had nothing when they were kids, so they wanted to make sure we got anything that we wanted, which was a mistake. Because we were like, oh, I want that. Mm. And we were huge on comics and magazines. And so I grew up, you know, man, I'd really like to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we got every comic book ever made. I'd like to have the amount that they spent, you know, at a dime a comic.
Yeah.
On us. And we'd take stacks of them to our children, to our dentist when we were done with them.
Yeah.
And they'd just laugh going, your parents bought you all these?
Yeah.
And you read them? Just, yeah, I read each one of them like 10 times. You
know? Yeah.
Yeah, I was into it. And then, you know, TV. I was so into TV. So the mixture of, and my parents subscribed to every magazine there was because my dad couldn't say no to the kids who came around.
Right, right.
So we had every magazine.
I was one of those kids.
I was the top salesman once I could Woo! Do it because my dad bought them all. Anyway, we had every magazine, we had TV, and we had comics throughout growing up. So I was just completely bombarded with graphic images.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, by the time I was a teenager, Yeah, I wanted to be a sign painter or a graphic artist. Commercial artist is what they were called back then.
Yeah, yeah.
But then I went and visited two of the most successful graphic artists in my hometown. I went to...
Sacramento?
Yeah. I went to the preeminent sign painter,
mm-hmm.
and he had... This was so cool. This guy had... it was House of Signs, and he had about 10 people that made... This is back before any computers, back before...
Right.
This is all hand-done signs.
Tape layout, carbon, and...
There hardly any tape. These guys were unbelievable.
They'd create masks with just an X-Acto and some paper and...
Spray. Oh, well, they had a silk screen department.
Silk screen, okay.
But no, yeah. I'm talking about sign painters.
Mm-hmm.
Sign painters. He had a silk screen department that, you know, sure. God, it was making, that was huge business, but he had about 8 guys who painted signs.
Actually painted them.
Painted them.
Like made art on a big old freaking mural. How big are those things?
Well, it just depends. They could be as big as a small size billboard done in about 4 by 8 sheets.
Right.
And or they could be as overnight. Small as something that went in a movie lobby, but these guys could paint anything. And I went to visit this guy when I was 17.
Uh-huh.
My girlfriend's stepmother, she was big in radio advertising. She knew all these guys. And I told her what I wanted to do. And she goes, I know all these guys. So first she sends me to House Signs. A guy comes out smoking a cigar. Hey, what do you want? I go, oh, you know, Heather sent me. Ah, hurry up. You know, I'm busy. I'm like, holy shit. Well,
paint fumes got to him.
So he takes me through his shop, which was just derelict, the conditions these guys worked in. And one guy was painting a 4x6 image of an office building,
uh-huh.
painting it. And it looked like the photograph that he was painting it from.
Wow.
And this guy is just painting it.
Uh-huh.
I mean, he's got rulers, but I'm like, what? And then I go around a corner and there's a guy that's painting something like a, you know, for sale sign on a 3x4 foot sheet of plywood. Right. And he's doing it with a house paintbrush.
Yeah.
Big ass brush and just boop, 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 boop. What? And I'm like, it was like perfect lettering and not a, you know, perfect paint application. I'm like, what? So by the time I did one lap through this guy's store, I realized I'm not that talented. And these guys were all like half bum type guys. I mean, they were guys who, you know, they were like hardcore guys. And I was like, wow, this is really, really something. Those guys,
grind.
Ultra talented. So I left there and wow. And then I went across town to the hot young graphic designer who was probably about 35 at the time. And he was maybe even 30. And he was doing, you know, the big super graphics from it was in the late 60s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, big, giant paintings of, they were just super big stripes and stuff that were backgrounds of images. But, you know, and he just looked at the stuff I brought him, you know, my little portfolio that I had, which was pitiful. And he said, oh, this stuff's pretty good. You just need to make it about 5,000 times bigger.
Oh, wow.
Okay, so fast forward like 40 years.
Yeah.
Not that, 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I married the sign painter's daughter.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I became very best friends with the graphic designer guy, who was a big mentor to me, really great guy.
One of the things about, you know, the field of printing, blueprinting in particular, but printing probably more, is you are always integrating with artists. Architects are artists. You came up in the printing business, so people who did art were starting to do computer stuff and bring that to you. So that became part of your community. And so you've really kind of followed the thread, even though you had your regular kind of tied in to the art community at some level.
Well, I didn't get tied into the art community till about 1982. I don't know. My dad had died. I'd taken over his business. I'd expanded it. And then opened up a new store, and in this new store, it was really architecturally splendid, which nobody was doing at the time in Sacramento. Mm-hmm. We won an architectural award for the improvement, the tenant improvement. Anyway, the...
Talking about, you got an award for tenant improvement.
But my contact with the arts world, designing this store, and I went to one of the oldest architectural firms on our books and said, I want you guys to do this store. And they go, you want us to do it? We're old. And they said, we got a young guy that would love to do that. They'd gotten this new guy and they hooked me up with him. And right off the bat, I told him, man, there's no budget on this. I really am going to blow the, just spending all our money on this. And he's like, awesome. You know, just what an architect wants to hear. And about 10 minutes into our meeting, he goes, you need to meet the artist in the community because you need to make the connection between architecture and art. And I was, my whole store, this store was trying to go out, it was designed to go out and get more architectural clients, and it wasn't just a blueprint store. There was a whole other thing.
You wanted to put a marketing front on that store that
super.
That
they made were, it, so there was a story.
These with are our it. People, kind of thing.
Yeah, I really wanted them to go. We don't want to go anywhere else. And this was a really specialized store. It wasn't just blueprinting, but that's another deal. Anyway, this guy started introducing me to artists, and I was like, wow. And these people were all serious artists. They still are serious artists. I'm in touch with all of them. They've all, you know, become name artists in that region. And I commissioned a piece from 7 different artists. And all of them were like, whoa. And, you know, for the time in Sacramento, it was like pretty weird that somebody would go do that. Somebody would do this.
Right.
You know, because there was no art in public places program then. There was no conscience about putting art anywhere. But mm-hmm. this guy convinced me I should do it. And I look back on it and go, that was the best thing I ever did, man. I got introduced to the art world really once these people knew I was serious about supporting them and supporting art with my business. Mm-hmm. Oh, man, I was in, you know, I became really good friends with all of them, and a lot more. And as we expanded the business, we just kept getting stupider with the commissions that we did on both the architecture end and the art end. So that's what got me hooked on it, was being so well connected to artists and their dedication to it, knowing what it took to make art. Mm-hmm. And so I never had the time to do it, and never thought I'd ever, you know, like some people go, man, I spent 200 hours on this piece, and I'd go, what the hell's wrong with you? You know, why? Well, that's just how long it takes. And I thought,
right,
man, if it takes longer than, you know, an hour.
There's a lot more process than what you see in front of you when it comes to art. And part of process is processing and assimilating. And so an artist will get an idea, and that idea will play out in their head for sometimes years before they even put pen to paper, or, you know, pixel to whatever you're putting pixels to, kilobytes, I don't know.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you look at the value of art, it's really hard to put a price on it. And some of the art, all the art really represents a lot of dedication and time. Before that piece, the thousands of other pieces before it.
True.
You know?
Well, yeah, you know, once you start making pieces, you don't even really, I don't know. I don't, unless it's a commission, I don't think about the time I'm putting into it. If it's a commission, you know, and I know the value of the commission, I try to keep my hours within a reasonable amount. Mm-hmm. So I can, you know, at least go, wow, you know, that was worth it.
Right.
You know? But, man, when I'm making a piece, I did one piece, I decided to...
Changes what you're making it for.
To dissect the human body. There's this... I make montages, and I take images that I clip out of other images in Photoshop and put them into a different order to make an image. Anyway, I got hooked on the human body. There was a medical atlas published in 1849 in France where they had three dead people and they dissected them. And as they dissected them, they painted every scene and every organ and every single thing about, you know, dissecting a human. And they're gorgeous paintings. And I just love this stuff. So I decided I had to, you know, what I like to do is create a library of images from a certain book or theme and then make something from that. So, man, I call them clips. I must have clipped out in Photoshop 200 of the pieces of the body and body parts and organs and stuff. And I got to this one image, and it was like, it's an image of a guy splayed open totally, and it shows the person dissecting him with their hand on his brain, and it shows the entire nerve root system from his brain out. Looks like a really, really, really bizarre underwater
creature.
Plant.
Yeah.
Tree. And I thought, wow. And I was just really getting good at cutting these things out in Photoshop. And I thought, you know, I'm going to cut that out.
You see, you went meticulous.
Oh, they're meticulous. You know it. Yeah. I mean, to these things.
You're talking about the nerve endings in the whole body.
Oh, yeah. In this image, the in the page, the image is about 11 inches high by 6 inches wide.
Mm.
And imagine just a really weird looking tree system kind of.
Octopus.
Even weirder than that, but more filaments.
Yeah, a lot of filaments. Mycelium.
So they are on the page about a 32nd, not even that, a 64th of an inch wide. And when I blow them up to clip them, they're probably a full eighth of an inch wide. And at that scale, it took me 8 hours to cut out this one thing.
Oh, my gosh.
And what's weird is that I've never used it.
Never used it.
I have it, if I ever want to use it.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Right? So you look at time put into art and go, whoa, what?
Yeah. Yeah. Remember when the pixels were chunky?
Oh, well, we were one of the pioneers in digital printing.
You'd have to clean everything up, just chunk. Because you couldn't get a good scan of anything.
Well, no.
So you had to reconfigure everything. And anti-aliasing was kind of okay, but bullshit, really. I mean,
Now I had these really young technicians working for me it was in the late 80s and early 90s. These like pinhead 15-year-olds, guys who could take apart Ataris and stuff like that, and Nintendos, and customize them. You know, when they were like 12, these kids were like goofy. I mean, I was hiring them when they were like 17 because their parents didn't want them around, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so it was like, let them work, you know? And so the head of our digital lab was 19 years old, and this kid was a genius.
Started when he was 16?
He started when he was 16.
Wow.
Great story about this guy. He starts when he's 16, and he was just this Van Halen screwball, hair to his butt.
Rocker.
Wannabe rocker.
Rocker.
He didn't have any money, didn't have an electric guitar, but he knew how to play guitar. But so
he loved rock and roll, though.
So he needed a job. So he came to us and he got a job. You know, we were the outcast employer. So this guy came to us and he was working, and we thought, man, this guy's just weird, man. He's kind of cool, because we were all, you know, stoners, and thought he's kind of weird, but man, he's just out there. He's got this edge to him. So he'd worked for us for a couple years, and we ended up getting this giant contract, and we realized we needed to set up a night crew. And we went to we had about 40 people working for us. We went to and said, who wants to work at night? And nobody raised their hands. And we were like, wow, bummer. And the next day, this guy came up and said, hey, man, I'll work at night. And we said, well, by yourself? And he's like, yeah, I can work harder than three other people. I go, well, you know that. What's the deal? He goes, as long as you let me have my own sound system here,
nice,
I'll do it. And we're like, man, you are in. So this guy was our one-man night crew for like 6 months.
Van Halen, you know.
And then he convinced his friends who were just like him, just these crazy, genius metal bangers.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, he became our digital guy. Yeah, and he led us into the 21st century, man. This guy was a trip.
So your night guy was just a headbanger, and all of his friends, they were kind of night people too then, I guess.
Well, huh? they were so young, they didn't know the difference, you know, as long as they could stay up.
Dude, I'm fucking up my circadian rhythm.
They were, these kids were a trip.
Oh, but night work will fuck you up.
Made me a fortune. They were great.
Yeah. Well, you got, so in that business, the blueprint business, it's a lot like any other business where it's feast or famine, and it's always right now when everybody wants their stuff. So having a 24-hour running setup is perfect, because when those happen, you've got your night crew to pull you through. And when you don't have that, what you end up being is the night crew and the day crew for about 3 days straight. And
well, yeah, ass. But we were growing by leaps and bounds with our area.
Mm-hmm.
And when I grew up, you know, I grew up the son of a blueprinter. And there were definitely feast and famine seasons.
Sure.
Because construction stopped. Well, the interest rates never moved back then.
That's true. They were always
high. It wasn't it. The things that changed things were a recession or bad weather. And, you know, construction stopped in the winter back then. They didn't build things back in the winter.
Right.
So winters were always lean for blueprinters. Well, my dad had diversified the company a little bit, but when I was working for him, I worked for him, you know, hardcore for 7 years before he died, from when I was 19 to 27. And I mean, that whole time I was on his back to expand. We need to get services in here that will make us recession proof.
Mm.
So when there are down times, we have stuff that we can produce that aren't like copying.
Right.
Come on. We had a captive audience, but didn't provide a high-speed copying service when we should have. So, I mean, man, he wasn't dead more than 10 minutes, and I ordered a high-speed copier from Xerox. Man, are you kidding me?
Put it changed in the lobby, everything. 10 cents a click.
Well, no,
you're paying two?
No. We did that stuff. These were like 120 copy a minute copiers to print books that went along with architectural.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Spec books. Like big-time copying.
Yeah.
And we ended up having four of those.
Yeah. Collate, you know. Do three books at a time.
Yeah. Kind of thing. Well, so well, that was stuff like that. But yeah.
That's
going
crazy.
Going big in that printing, we got diversified, so we never had to worry about a recession. And later, as we got bigger and bigger and bigger, it was hard to describe to even existing clients, much less prospective clients, how diversified we were. So we came up with the whole ad thing. We were 10 businesses in one.
Okay. Yeah.
We were a copier. Mm-hmm. We were a photo processor. We were a blueprinter. We were digital printing. We were giant digital printing. We were a delivery service. You know, you add it all up. We were 10 businesses in one.
That's a lot to manage.
We kicked ass. I had great people. It was all managing people. My skill was finding them and training them and keeping them.
Yeah, boy.
Paying them.
Finding them is the thing, and paying them to keep them. Because each person's got their basic living standard that they have to keep, that they want to keep.
And well, back in those days, it was a, God, I mean, blueprinting was down at the lowest ladder of employment, seriously.
Right. Oh, yeah.
And everyone we hired was like me, you know, no degree.
Right.
Maybe some college, generally just high school.
Yeah, a couple years
of junior
college.
So we hired people who were, you know, and we just nurtured them like they were pals of ours, you know, and it worked. Ended up, when I started with When I took over the company, there were 22 of us, and when I sold it, there were 150 people.
It's Lost Boys. It works. Yeah. You know, it yeah. does. I mean, yeah. you know, all anybody needs is respect and love and enough dignity when they go home to say, I worked for this, and it looks good, it feels good.
Yeah, and these people had no life plans. I mean, really, right. seriously, I mean, hardly any of them came to us. They were young and goofy like us, you know.
Right.
And so the deal was, is we were trying to tell them to have a life plan.
Right.
This is a cool place to work, you know.
Right.
We had a pension plan, we had a medical plan, we had, you know, towards the end we had child care because it was like we needed to, you know.
Right.
So yeah, we had all that shit.
Because I got kids. Well, what's that going to... You got three of those running, and but they're the best doggone hustlers you ever had.
Yeah.
Yeah. Give them some security. Wow.
Anyway, it was a cool company.
Yeah, sounds like you guys...
Then I sold it, and they all got screwed.
Oh, man. That's
not
sad,
all of them,
it?
But most of them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I mean, I did the same thing. I had my eggs in the basket. My basket was a lottery. I was planning on another... 12 years there, you know? Yeah. I mean, and then that just got tanked. And now I'm like, okay. So I tried to refigure it, and I'm at the end of refiguring and close to retirement, but I'm not ready to retire. I'm too young for that. My life feels like in two parts. It feels like how I'm rolling this.
You're lucky it's just two.
Well, two big parts, like two major parts. Well, there's, oh God, yeah, how many parts? I'm lucky it's a lot of parts, actually. And but in terms of like the two halves of life, at some level, I feel like I'm going to live a long time. And at another level, I feel like I could die tomorrow. And
my parents both died at 60. I never expected to make it to 50 the way I was living. And then when I passed 60, it was like, what now? And when I sold my company, I was like 44.
Right.
And I thought, man, if I, you know, I've got enough money to make it to 70.
Yeah.
I'm 73, and I'm going, whoa.
Oh, shit, starting to run out.
Anyway, on that note, I got to go.
Well, that was a good show. Ladies and gentlemen,
thanks for having me.
Thank you, Bob. This was awesome.
I have to go.
And you have a great
dinner
day.
For the wife and her kids. It's girls' night at my house. So
oh, girls' night. All right, if you need a friend, call. Garland Pepper out. Love yourself, love your others. That's the rules.
That's it.